Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, March 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital and its Saratoga Medical Group, with more than 30 specialty practices, including eye care, allergy, ear, nose, and throat, and pain management on its Wilton campus, saratogahospital.org. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians. He is here to discuss internal medicine and nephrology. He is board certified in both. Promises to be an interesting program, so give us a call early. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Vincent Carcillo and your calls coming up on Medical Monday. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians is here to discuss internal medicine and nephrology. He's board certified in both areas. Dr. Carcillo has been with CDRP since 2004 and is the current president and managing partner of the practice. A grad of the University of Scranton, he completed medical school at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. He trained in nephrology at Albert Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia. His clinical focus is on home dialysis. If you want to be a part of today's conversation, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Vincent Carcillo, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you here once again. Let's start at the beginning before we take calls today, and let's just talk about kidney disease for a minute. What is the first sign that usually presents to clients that come to your office?
That's a great question, because in fact, many people who have chronic kidney disease don't have any symptoms, which is what makes it so dangerous and so important for people to have regular follow-ups with their primary care physician, so that if there are other signs that people might not be feeling, such as abnormalities in their blood work or in their urine testing, that kind of thing, that they can get care that they need.
You know, you mentioned that a lot of people just don't have symptoms at the outset. How far along, let's say patient A comes to see you and is not feeling well, and then you say, oh my gosh, you've got kidney disease. How far along is that average patient when you first see them?
There's a staging system, right, for chronic kidney disease, stages 1 through 5. One being the point where something's wrong, but the kidney function overall is very good, all the way through stage 5 chronic kidney disease, which is the point where many people are starting to need dialysis. Now, I would say by far the largest stage in which we start to see patients for the first time is in stage 3. And even at that stage, many people are not really having many symptoms, although many of those patients do have other medical problems that they are being treated for, the most common ones being diabetes and high blood pressure. So in many cases, those patients do know that they've got medical problems, but maybe not that those medical problems have caused some damage to their kidneys. We sometimes don't even see symptoms related to the kidney failure itself until later in stage 4 and sometimes even into stage 5.
What do you know about genetics and what role they play? We know that diabetes, high blood pressure, smoking are all big indicators that, okay, down the road you could have some kidney issues. Are there folks who don't do any of those things or don't have any of those issues that it's just a strictly genetic, your dad had this, you got it now?
Yeah. There are some people who do have a genetic disposition towards chronic kidney disease, and many of those people do have family members who have had sometimes these other issues as well, like high blood pressure, and sometimes high blood pressure and kidney disease, it go round and round. High blood pressure can cause kidney disease can cause high blood pressure. But there are certainly some genetic diseases of the kidney, which are much more rare than things like diabetes and high blood pressure, but certainly things that we see. And some of those diseases involve formation of what some people have heard this term, cysts in the kidney. And there are some people who have a genetic disposition to make more and more and more of these cysts, which are like bubbles in the tissue, that eventually kind of squeeze out that normal, good, healthy, functioning kidney tissue and cause progressive damage.
We're joined today by Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians, and our number is 800-348-2551. Are there some people who are genetically predisposed to get kidney stones?
To get kidney stones?
Yes.
Yeah, there are, you know, as far as kidney stones go, most people who do end up developing a kidney stone, those stones are formed largely with calcium. And many times it's the result of being underhydrated, you know, kind of dehydrated, and sometimes related to some of the things that we're doing that we think are good for us, like taking calcium and vitamin D supplements. And what's interesting is that, you know, most people who do make a kidney stone, even those that are become symptomatic, and some are not do not cause symptoms, but those that even do have symptoms, many of them will never form a kidney stone again. There are some people, and you mentioned, and the genetic disposition exists in some people, that they do continue to make stones, and it's unfortunate because it can be a very painful process, but certainly one that we can provide treatment for.
I mean, do we know why some are predisposed to that?
Yeah, in fact, some people are predisposed because and there are genetics that are involved with this, that they have too much of the things that come together to make stones. And those things include calcium and phosphorus and oxalate and uric acid and things like that. These things can combine together to create crystals, which eventually become stones. Now, some people have too much of these things entering the urine where they can come together to make stones. And in other people, they don't excrete enough of this other substance, which actually kind of blocks those things from coming together. We call those stone inhibitors. So, and those, and that can be influenced by other things like medications too, not just their genetics.
We're joined today by Dr. Vincent Carcillo, and Dr. Carcillo will handle a couple of emails here, and then we'll take a quick break, and then we will go to the phones. Our number is 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Dr. Vincent Carcillo. This email from John. John says, does significant exercise and muscular exertion metabolize more protein before protein can burden the kidneys?
So it's a great question, and certainly exercise is a healthy thing to do. As far as burning more protein when you're exercising, it's not one of the first things that you metabolize. Usually you're metabolizing a version of glucose, which is a sugar in your blood, which is very simple and easy to burn. You have to be exercising for some time before you start burning protein. Now, as far as that being a factor in kidney disease, there are some people who think that it's a good idea to really take in excessive amounts of protein in order to build muscle, and that can be sometimes problematic with regard to the kidney's ability to handle those protein loads.
Hmm. This is from Irene, and then we'll take a quick break. And Irene says,
sure.
Can long-term, parentheses, several years, use of Adderall or other medications cause chronic kidney disease?
So Adderall is a stimulant, and it can have long-term effects on the cardiovascular system. There's no evidence that I'm aware of that there's any specific target site of damage within the kidney. But if you're someone who already has high blood pressure, taking a stimulant, which can sometimes raise blood pressure, can put you at higher risk than you may have previously been at.
All right, let's take a quick break here, and then to the phones we shall go. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians joins us. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, Medical Monday, Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We talk nephrology today with Dr. Vincent Carcillo, and let's go to Niskayuna. Rick, who's obviously on a speakerphone. Hello, Rick.
Hi. I know that you're specialized in kidney, but I was wondering if you could answer a question about prostate. I had a PSA exam that was above 4.0, and then it went up again to 4.3 and then 4.8. So I went to a urologist who recommended an MRI and a biopsy. And then I found out doing some research that maybe the biopsy possibly has risks, and the thinking is that it could if there were cancer, it could release the cancer to the rest of the body. So what's your opinion on biopsies? I'm 55-year-old male. Thanks,
Rick.
Thanks, Rick. And yeah, prostate is not generally one of the things that we treat in the office, especially as far as biopsy goes. But biopsy is considered to be the gold standard for prostate cancer screening at this point. So, you know, case by case, there may be other ways to go about it, and imaging is one of those ways. But I think if you're concerned about whether or not you're on the right track in terms of your own specific diagnosis, and you already have the help of a urologist, it might make you feel more comfortable, just like with any specialty or any medical advice. If you don't feel completely comfortable with it, you might want to get a second opinion, and that way you have another specialist giving you their opinion, which may agree or disagree with the original opinion. And then you can kind of take that and go from there.
Rick, thank you very much for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Lucy in Zena, New York. Lucy, I got to tell you, I've never heard of Zena. I've been all around New York. Where's Zena, New York?
It's outside of Woodstock, along the Sauk Hill.
And it's spelled Z-E-N-A? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
It's German. It's German, right. Like feminine of Zeus, I guess.
I'm gonna have to go there.
It was Wagenonk in the Indian time, but it's Zena now.
Very interesting.
Anyway, calling for a friend who is it unusual, doctor, for someone to black out? Just black out prior to knowing that they had some kind of kidney misfunction or kidney issue? Is that very unusual for that to happen?
Okay.
Hello.
So, you know, as far as blacking out goes, we would say, you know, would you also say that this person, you know, another way of saying that would be that person passed out?
Or
they
lost
consciousness?
Got disoriented.
Is that the kind of,
No. No, not lost consciousness, not exactly lost consciousness, but lost track of what was happening and can't remember prior to, I don't think they fell or anything like that, but they would just became like completely disoriented out of nowhere.
Okay.
They're not typically like that. They haven't been like that since.
Mm.
And then subsequent to emergency room visit, there was an issue around urination, and now he's going for further tests now, but they think maybe kidney involvement.
Mm-hmm. Well, when something like that happens acutely, where you have an acute problem with consciousness and memory and that kind of thing, the first thing that comes to mind is kind of a neurologic issue. And we're always mm-hmm. worried about that. Depending upon the age of the person, could be different things that you would consider. Now, although there's nothing specific about having kidney disease that should make you have that kind of acute kind of neurologic kind of issue, there are times when kidneys are affected by things like infection or obstruction, where because of the infection, that that people can have an effect that changes their level of consciousness and things like that. Happens very commonly with urinary tract infections, especially in the elderly population.
Well, thank you so much. That makes total sense. Appreciate it.
Lucy.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Thank you very much for the call. Dr. Vincent Carcillo joins us. It's 800-348-2551. If you want to chime in here on a Medical Monday, Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Have there been any advances in using other ACE inhibitors other than captopril and enalapril that have been available for the past 30 years for treating diabetic nephropathy?
Well, that's a great question and a very timely question too. The class of medications that you mentioned, these ACE inhibitors, are a type of blood pressure medication. And you're also right that they've been around for quite a long time. And that was the first medication that was really studied in the diabetic population. And they were studied more in kind of type 1 diabetics than type 2. Type 2 being the kind of diabetes that we're more commonly familiar with in the older population, population that tends to be a little bit heavier and resistant to insulin. And then came a cousin to that class, which was called ARBs. And ARBs is a similar kind of blood pressure medicine that also lowered protein in the urine, which is a marker for damage from diabetes, and also helped to preserve some kidney function. Now, those two medications are tried and true, but we do have a newer type of medication that shows real promise, and that's another type of medicine to treat diabetes called SGLT2 inhibitors. And that this type of medication, the trial was actually ended early because the results looked so promising with regard to cardiovascular disease and the prolonging worsening kidney function in those diabetic patients and patients that had protein in their urine with chronic kidney disease. So that's a great question. And the answer is yes now.
Jim, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We're joined today by Dr. Vincent Carcillo on this Medical Monday, and we go now to West Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Bernard, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had an interesting series of events. I had a liver transplant in 2012. Since then, I've been taking an anti-rejection med, tacrolimus, for the liver, and that coupled with ibuprofen. I was hospitalized in December with pneumonia and was discharged after they treated that double pneumonia with fungal pneumonia. It was. They called me back a couple of weeks later and said for some reason my creatinine level had gone through the roof after I was discharged, and they needed me to come in that day for a liver biopsy. I said, no, I have to come into the hospital. So I went in. Since then, they treated me with methylprednisolone, followed by these 3 to 4 hour infusions of something called rituximab, and said that that should arrest the kidney inflammation. I just wanted to hear your insight on things, because they had said, you know, this is serious. I had actually driven from Massachusetts to the University of Pennsylvania, where I had my liver transplant 9 years ago, to get a second opinion. And they said, the rheumatologist there said, no, absolutely, go with the treatment and start it as soon as you can. So anything you got on that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Sure. There's a whole lot to unpack there.
Yep.
And I hope that the treatment has helped you. I hope that you're doing better. But there are a number of things that come to mind there. You know, medication for liver transplant, specifically this medicine that's called tacrolimus, is a similar type of medication. We actually use tacrolimus for patients that have kidney transplant too. And although
right.
It's a very good medication at preventing rejection of both organs, over time, it does have kind of what we call a vasoconstrictive effect, or a closing of the blood vessels, which can cause chronic kidney damage moving forward. And it usually takes some time, usually 10 to 20 years after transplants, do we see the, you know, organs can start to have problems related to the medication, although the medication was being used for good reason. Now, in your case, you also had a second problem, which was you got really sick with pneumonia. So there are times when levels of that medication can become too high, and that can affect your kidney function. There are times when other medications like antibiotics, or you mentioned fungus, medicines to treat fungus can cause changes in the levels of those medications, which can again hurt the kidney's function. So there are a lot of variables there, and hard to say exactly what it was that specifically hurt your kidneys. But rituximab is another medication altogether that you mentioned is used IV as an infusion, and that is used to treat a number of diseases, and one of them is called vasculitis. And if you saw a rheumatologist, it makes me wonder if there was something like that going on, but too hard to say with the kind of complicated nature of your case. But I am glad to hear that you're feeling better.
Bernard, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday, and we welcome Dr. Vincent Carcillo from Capital District Renal Physicians. And let's now go to Kingston, New York. And Katrina, Kingston, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
You betcha.
Hi.
I'm new to dialysis, but soon I'm going to be having it at home. And my question is, is there pros and cons in getting a kidney, or can I just continually be on dialysis?
Hi, that's a great question, and I'm so glad to hear that you're going to be transitioning to home dialysis. Home dialysis is really my passion, and I think that there are so many benefits to being able to do your dialysis treatments at home. Are you dialyzing in a center right now?
Well, I'm going to just start the training.
Okay. And are you receiving the hemodialysis treatments now, though?
Yes, I received it on my chest, and they inserted whatever you call it in my stomach, and that healed. Mm-hmm. And soon I'm going to be doing the training before I go, you know, do it home on my own.
Right. Okay, yeah. And that catheter, which is a tube for people who don't know, it gets placed in the stomach area, just to the left or the right of the belly button, and that allows a person to get treatment for kidney failure, which is dialysis. And dialysis requires us to clean the blood, because that's what kidneys are supposed to be doing when they're healthy and functioning. And so with the peritoneal dialysis, you actually never see any blood. Clear fluid will go in through that tube into your belly. It'll fill it up for a while and then drain out. And when that fluid drains, believe it or not, it takes with it some of the things that were building up in your system that were making you feel sick. So it's a very good way of doing it, because you can do that at home around your own schedule and have the privacy and autonomy that comes with being at home. So I think it's a great choice.
But is there a pro or con to getting a transplant or not getting a transplant?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another great question. And, you know, getting a transplant, what we do see is that the percentage of patients that get transplants is actually higher for home dialysis than it is for people who are receiving dialysis in the center. So if anything, it probably works in your favor that you're dialyzing at home statistically. Although, you know, for kidney transplant, it still involves all the same process of getting all the testing done, testing for your heart, testing for making sure that you've had all your cancer screening and colonoscopies and things like that, and then going through the procedure. But there's nothing about home dialysis that should hold you up from getting a kidney transplant.
Katrina, thanks a lot for the call, and we appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Dr. Vincent Carcillo is our guest. Now, when you've been on in the past, we have talked about home dialysis. And one question I always have is one of safety and cleanliness. Let me put it in perspective. CPAPs, for instance. A lot of people use CPAPs. One of the real drawbacks is you have to rely on the patient to keep it clean. Otherwise, there are a host of other things that can happen from a dirty CPAP machine. What safeguards are there in place to make sure home dialysis stays clean, sanitary, and safe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Such a great question. I mean, it's absolutely what you would worry about to think that, you know, and I think many patients think this too, and sometimes even clinicians, that can I trust that this is going to go well? Can I trust that there, like you said, will be a clean environment, or that the patient will do what they need to do, even with sterile technique like washing their hands? And so we go through a rigorous process with patients before they start at home. So before a patient ever does a treatment at home, we have a team that goes out to the home to make sure that the setting is appropriate. And then for at least 1 week for peritoneal dialysis, which is the belly type that we just talked about, and longer than that, sometimes 2 to 3 weeks for the hemodialysis, which is a blood dialysis that's done at home, the patient gets a tremendous amount of training so that their technique is clean and so that they can read the prompts on the machines in order to make the adjustments that they need to make. And the patients, even after going home, have access to our nurses 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And they also, if there's a problem with their machine, have access to the company that supplies those machines. And we can sometimes get a brand new machine out to a patient overnight if needed. So it's a great question, and one that in the past that we did sometimes struggle with, but we can do this with great confidence, I think, at this point.
If you have any idea at all, and I'm not sure you have these numbers in front of you, how many people across the country are on home dialysis?
Home dialysis, we see historically, and this is interesting, back when dialysis was really in its infancy in the 60s and 70s, more patients actually were able to do dialysis at home because we didn't really have outpatient dialysis units like we do now. It wasn't really until 1973 when, at that time, President Nixon signed a bill into law making all patients who have end-stage kidney disease eligible for Medicare that centers for treatment started to pop up more and more and more, and home dialysis kind of fell off, and more patients were enrolled in hemodialysis. And so historically, home dialysis has only been 7 to 8% of all dialysis patients, but more recently, that number is now climbing, and that number is currently at about 10 to 12%. And most of those patients, about 80% of the patients that are dialyzing at home right now, do the belly type, which is peritoneal dialysis. About 20% of those patients are doing another type of dialysis, which is a hemodialysis, a blood dialysis that they can do at home.
Dr. Vincent Carcillo joins us, and let's grab another call here before the next break. Judy is in Del Mar. Judy, you're on.
Thank you. My daughter-in-law has fibrocystic disease of the kidneys, very early stage. She's in her early 40s. Her father has it as well, a little more advanced, and he's being medically managed. But so this is not troubling her so much right now. But what is that she has huge cysts in her liver, which are progressing very rapidly and is causing a great deal of discomfort. So she's probably going to seek medical attention from a hepatologist. But I wanted to understand, you know, what we might be facing here, what her treatment options will be, et cetera, for the more aggressive, you know, liver cysts.
Well, thank you. And now I know you said the word fibrocystic, but is this something that you said also her father has this? and other people on his side of the family as well?
Yeah, she has that genetic version of, the cysts in the kidneys.
So could it be something that's called polycystic kidney disease? Does that sound familiar?
It could be, yes. Yes, yeah. I might have gotten that wrong. Right.
And sure.
What she indicated to me is that the cysts in the liver are related. I don't know if that's true or not, but...
Yes, and so there are some forms of this disease that cysts form in other places like liver and sometimes pancreas. The cysts themselves, I think I may have started to mention this earlier, the cysts themselves are not necessarily toxic like or masses like a cancer, but more and more of them develop and the organ kind of stretches out and the normally functioning areas start to fail. And so with polycystic kidney disease, many times it follows similar patterns in families where, people generally with that disease on a certain side of the family will have end-stage disease by the time they reach their, 50s or 60s or 70s, different patterns in different families. And there are some different genetic patterns, too. So... I take it she has a kidney specialist yet or no?
Yes, she does. But now she's, because of the liver complications, she's going to have to go to a liver specialist, a hepatologist. So that's what I'm more concerned about because that seems to be progressing rapidly, and she's very uncomfortable and in pain many days because it's, I assume, pressing on all kinds of other organs in there. It's quite enlarged. You can, see the protrusion in her body, So I just was wondering if you knew what we'd be facing here, what the treatment options are.
Yeah, I'm sorry that she's having to go through that, and that can certainly be overwhelming. When the organs start to get large, and sometimes even if the liver is not involved, those kidneys can become very, very big. And I've seen those organs eventually have to be removed because they were so big, and there are times when those organs can weigh upwards of 25 pounds because they've just gotten so large in size. And you can imagine that taking up so much space in the abdomen that, it's hard to eat because you feel full so quickly and kind of that increased in pressure and everything pushing on each other can create a lot of discomfort and pain. Now, depending on what the kidney function is.
Can this be medically reduced or surgically removed?
So the cysts can sometimes be reduced, but that generally does not solve the bigger problem because they continue to form. So there are times when we've removed one of the kidneys for symptomatic relief, and that sometimes can be very helpful. What does matter, though, in situations like that is what your kidney function is and what the kidney doctor and urologist think might be left as far as kidney function after one of those kidneys has been removed.
Dr. Carcillo and Judy, thank you, Judy, for the call. Dr. Carcillo, please stay with us. We got to take a break. We're way overdue here. It's Medical Monday, 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC Medical Monday. We're talking nephrology today with Dr. Vincent Carcillo, and the number is 800-348-2551. Nancy in Clifton Park. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. About lupus nephritis. Can you tell me how that
works? Oh, Nancy, your connection's very, very poor, Nancy. If you are standing in one spot, try to stand on a phone book or something.
Okay. I'm driving, so I'm
don't do that,
in
then.
A different spot.
All right. That's
hear me
good.
Now?
Yep. Go ahead. Yes.
Okay. So I have a question about lupus nephritis and how that process works and what kind of things a lupus patient can do to preserve the health of their kidneys if they've already got the beginning of damage.
Hi, Nancy. Yes.
Yes.
I think I heard your whole question there. And thanks for that. And, you know, lupus nephritis, we should start with, which is a disease of your immune system. And they call that an autoimmune disease, where the immune system kind of turns back and attacks itself. And so not everyone who has lupus develops nephritis, which is inflammation from the lupus within the kidney. But those that do can have very severe disease at times, and sometimes that can actually cause the kidneys to fail. The inflammation can become so severe. And so there are treatments for that. There are a number of medications, and we seem to be developing more medications as we go. There are a few newer medications that have just been approved, so I think that there's a lot of hope for our patients that do have lupus, and specifically lupus nephritis, which is lupus attacking the kidneys. So yes, absolutely, there's reason to be positive.
Nancy, thank you very much for the call. And now to West Stockbridge. Susan, you're on.
Hi there. I have two quick questions. I'm taking calcium and D, and I heard you mention them, but I wasn't sure what you said about them.
Okay, yeah. So I did mention them. And, you know, the vitamin D and calcium are both important for bone density and strengthening our bones and keeping them mineralized. We also live in an area here in upstate New York where we don't always have clear skies and good sunlight, which touches our skin and allows us to create some vitamin D for ourselves. So the incidence of vitamin D deficiency in our area is actually quite high. And if you look at, interestingly enough, if you look at the incidence of vitamin D deficiency, it goes up and up and up the further away you get from the equator. And that's true in the northern and the southern hemisphere. So in general, it can be a good thing, especially if you're deficient in that vitamin, to take a supplement. There are
oh, good.
People,
so it wasn't
though,
a negative, and I have severe osteoporosis.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
The
so
other question
it sounds like
I have is,
that.
Yeah, ahead, Susan.
I'm pretty much of a vegan. I'm trying to bring in some fish oil or fish, but I haven't done it yet. But for the omega-3s, but I eat a lot of foods that are high in oxalates: asparagus, dandelion greens, beets, cashews, nuts. Am I doing myself a disservice? I don't think I have any kidney issues, but.
So I take it you've never made a kidney stone before that you're aware of, right?
No, I go to the bathroom an awful lot, but I went to a urologist, and he thinks I have lymphedema. He thinks that could be an irritable bladder, but I don't believe I've ever had a kidney stone, but I just realize I eat a lot of high oxalic. You know, I try to get half my calcium from dandelion greens, escarole, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, diet and disease are things that kind of weave in and out and touch each other, and so like some other things, you know, if you have a medical problem that you may need to titrate your diet in a certain way, then, you know, if you were someone who did make a lot of calcium oxalate kidney stones, you might have to change that part of your diet. But knowing that you've never made kidney stones, at least that you're aware of, and it's never been an issue for you, I really don't see that it's a problem or that you would need to change your diet the way it stands right now.
Susan, thanks so much for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Linda's in Glens Falls. Hello there, Linda.
Good afternoon. I'm not a clinician, but I work in mental health, and I would like to ask the doctor, based on the fact that I know several people who have succumbed to kidney disease and several more who are suffering from it, how he feels about psychiatrists prescribing lithium for bipolar disorder. Long-term use.
Yeah, wow. Thanks for that question. You know, lithium is sometimes an extremely valuable tool for mental health and for psychiatrists to control mood disorders. And it's also true that lithium can cause chronic kidney damage. Now, we've always known that, and it's important, and I think that for the most part, those patients do get monitored, and so we'll know And sometimes it's symptoms, because sometimes the lithium can cause problems and patients have to urinate very frequently, and we see that as a complication or a side effect of lithium. But they can cause, lithium can cause damage to the kidneys too. And so in patients that are getting damage, we do sometimes make a recommendation that we try to find another medication to treat that patient's mood disorder. But there are some instances where there just is nothing else that works. And so in order to create quality of life for that patient, sometimes there's a trade-off that needs to be made. But something that we do sometimes struggle with patients in the office. That's a great question. Thank you.
Linda, thanks so much. 800-348-2551. Let's go now to Rock Hill, New York. And John, you're on.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, John.
I've been on dialysis. It'll be 6 years this coming May. And one of the things I've always been very curious about, is there anything that dialysis patients can take after getting treatment? In other words, to minimize or eliminate what I call the post-dialysis slump. For me, it's mental and physical. I get depressed and I get kind of beat up physically.
Yeah. Now, could you tell me the type of dialysis that you do?
Chemo.
Hemodialysis in the center, like 3 times a week?
Yes.
Yeah.
Fortunately for me, I go twice a week.
Twice a week. Okay. Now, that is something that does happen very commonly to patients, specifically with that type of dialysis. The reason for that is because the filters in those machines are very, very good. They're very efficient. But because they're so efficient, and the dialysis can be done in just a few hours, it sometimes can be very taxing on your system, especially if the machine needs to remove a lot of fluid. And so it's common in people who get that type of dialysis to get that washed out feeling afterwards. And there is sometimes very little that we can do to make that better. Sometimes spreading out and doing more dialysis treatments throughout the week can be helpful. Sometimes changing that modality, if your doctor thinks that you're a good candidate for the peritoneal dialysis through the belly, I rarely ever see that type of problem with that type of dialysis.
Thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Well, I understand what you're saying about the physical nature of the side effects, if you will, of this type of dialysis. But why the mental loss?
Yeah. So when your body's undergoing stress like that, and the stress of dialysis, you have lots of little particles in your blood that are making their way into this filter and leaving your system. And also, you know, while that's happening, you have a lot of blood that's flowing outside your body. That can sometimes affect your blood pressure. We talked a little bit earlier about a patient maybe that was starting to get this blackout or lightheaded or dizzy feeling. That can happen very commonly when blood pressure is changing rapidly from low to high or high to low. And so you can get those types of kind of physical effects affecting your mental status. And after dialysis, this washed out feeling is kind of a fatigue that affects you both physically and mentally as well.
Dr. Vincent Carcillo joins us on this Medical Monday. Richard is in Whitesboro. Richard, you're up.
Hi, thanks for taking the call, Ray. Sure. And doctor, I am calling probably for a lot of people here. I'm having to take PPI equivalent of twice a day. Dexplan is a time release, so it's equivalent of twice a day indefinitely. And in the literature that comes with the medicine, it tells watch out for kidney damage. And my question, therefore, is I was wondering roughly what are the chances that I'm not holding it to something specific, but just is it like a 10% chance, 5%, 80% if you have to take it indefinitely? And is there any particular damage that these PPIs will do to your kidneys? that might be different, and any particular tests, therefore, that might be peculiar or useful to use if you're on a PPI.
Ray, I have to tell you, your listeners are wonderful, and they call with such thoughtful questions. And so thanks for this one.
Yes.
You know, PPIs is something that comes up pretty frequently now in the office, because there has been some data available to us to suggest that that there is an associated increased risk of chronic kidney disease in patients that do need to take PPIs, or proton pump inhibitors, which is a medication that's used to treat heartburn, or sometimes people call that GERD. Now, there are sometimes an acute effect, which is something that happens quickly when people get exposed to that medication, which is kind of like an allergic reaction. We call it interstitial nephritis, and that can make your kidney function worse quickly. Other people have kind of a slower long-term effect, and it's less than, you know, when you said maybe my risk, maybe it's 10%. You know, it seems like it's significantly lower than that, but maybe somewhere in the 1-2% range. Now, the flip side to this, and we started talking about a medication earlier that we just couldn't avoid, there are some people that just don't get any relief from their heartburn from with any other medications. And so sometimes, especially, you know, if you can do this in coordination with your primary care doctor, if you don't already have kidney disease, it may be something that you can stay on, even though there is some risk with monitoring.
Richard, thank you very much. Very good question. And we only have about a minute here, a little less than that, doctor. This email from Irene: with chronic kidney disease 3B from unknown cause, is it reasonably safe to have a biopsy to diagnose, and will it definitively show the cause?
So I will do my best, because I know we're on the clock, to try to get through this quickly.
Okay.
So stage 3B, we kind of split stage 3 in half, because people in stage A, which is the kind of lighter side, don't progress as quickly. Stage 3B, those people do progress a little bit more quickly. Now, hard to say without knowing the specifics of this case, but in many patients who do warrant biopsy, biopsy can be a relatively safe procedure, again, as long as it's done in the right setting, which is in the hospital, and that there's a significant amount of monitoring after that procedure is done.
Wow, that was a superb job. Take a breath now, doctor. Hey, we're done. Thanks a lot for being here, Dr. Vincent Carcillo. We appreciate it.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. I always love to be on with you.
And we'll talk to you soon. Support comes from New York Oncology Hematology, 34 cancer providers across 6 Capital Region locations, offering second opinions at virtual visits, newyorkoncology.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Vincent Carcillo for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for calling. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, all right, we've done some mechanical work on your body. Now we'll do some mechanical work on your vehicle. It's automotive repair with Gordon Fricke tomorrow at 2 p.m. Be there for that one. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.